Hi, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be looking into something pretty foundational to our legal system. And I think, especially for you, as you're really diving deep into the law, this is going to be crucial. It's how federal courts have the power to look back at state criminal convictions when there's a question about whether constitutional rights were violated. We all know state courts, they handle a ton of criminal cases, but what happens when there's a real concern that a state trial, didn't quite follow someone's basic rights, their rights under the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, and that's really the heart of why Brown v. Allen, which was decided back in 1953, remains such an important case, even today, is this landmark decision that really defined the relationship between state and federal courts when you're dealing with these really significant constitutional challenges. These challenges are coming from people who've been convicted in state courts and they're saying, hey, my rights were violated. You can almost think of it as setting up the rules for this really important safety net, the safety net that's built right into our legal framework.
Okay, so Brown v. Allen, 1953. Let's set the scene a bit here. What were the actual cases, the real-world situations that led to this becoming such a pivotal Supreme Court case? Like, what were the human stories involved?
Sure. So we're talking about four black men in North Carolina, and they were facing the death penalty, two of them, Clyde Brown and Raleigh Speller. They had been convicted of interracial rape. And then there were the Daniels brothers, Benny and Lloyd Ray Daniels, who were just 17 years old at the time, and they had been convicted of murder. Now, these cases, they were just deeply troubling from the start. They raised these really, really serious allegations that because of their race, black citizens were just systematically being excluded from the juries. These are the juries that convicted them. And there were also these allegations that their confessions, the confessions that they had given, they weren't given freely. They were coerced, meaning that they were obtained through, pressure or tactics that are just flat out illegal.
Wow, yeah, those are incredibly serious accusations. I mean, if true, they strike right at the very heart of, what we consider a fair trial. So these four men, they went through the North Carolina state court system. What happened there?
Yeah, so their appeals within the state court system, they were unsuccessful. The North Carolina Supreme Court, they denied the appeals from Brown and Speller based on, the merits of their case, the legal arguments they made. And then Brown and Speller, they tried to go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. They filed what's called a petition for certiorari, but the Supreme Court denied that petition. And then with the Daniels brothers, their case was actually a little different. Their appeal through the state courts was denied because of a procedural issue. Their appeal was considered to be filed too late.
So the highest court in North Carolina had weighed in, and the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear the direct appeal at that point. Seems like that would be the end of the road, right? But this is where this whole idea of federal habeas corpus comes in. I mean, for folks who might be a little less familiar with that term, what exactly is habeas corpus, and why did these men turn to the federal courts after, everything that had already happened in the state courts?
That's a great question. So you're right, a denial of certiorari. That's when the Supreme Court decides, you know what, we're not going to hear this case right now. Often, that is the end of the typical appeals process. But federal habeas corpus, it's a separate pathway. You got to think of it not as directly appealing the state court's decision again. It's more like questioning whether someone is being held in prison legally, under federal law. And most often, that means arguing that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, has been violated. So in Brown v. Allen, these four men, they filed these habeas corpus petitions in a federal district court arguing, hey, during our trials back in state court, our constitutional rights weren't protected. Something went wrong there.
Got it. So it's a way to say, hold on, even if the state court made these decisions, let's make sure everything was done constitutionally. And how did the federal district court initially react to these petitions?
Right. So the federal district court, they did review everything, all the records from the trials that had taken place in the state courts. And sometimes, in some of these cases, they even looked at additional evidence, evidence that maybe wasn't presented before. But in the end, the district court, they ruled against all four men. They denied all four of the habeas petitions. And then after that, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, they upheld that decision from the district court.
So let me just recap here for a second, because this is getting a little complicated. We've got the state courts, they upheld the convictions. Then the U.S. Supreme Court, they declined to hear the direct appeal. And then on top of that, both the federal district court and the federal appeals court, they both sided with the state courts. It really sounds like the legal system had weighed in multiple times, on these cases. So what was it about Brown v. Allen that made it such a landmark, game-changing case? What was the big question that the Supreme Court decided to tackle this time around?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court, they agreed to hear this case for a very specific reason. They wanted to address this core question. Did all those previous proceedings, you know, all the decisions that had happened in the state courts and even the fact that the Supreme Court had denied certiorari earlier, did all of that basically prevent the federal courts from even considering the constitutional claims that were being raised in these habeas petitions? Mm. In other words, the real issue at the heart of this was, you know, did the federal courts still have the power, the authority, to independently look at these federal constitutional issues even after the state courts had already addressed them, you know, and even after the U.S. Supreme Court had chosen not to hear the direct appeal?
So the Supreme Court was really looking at the very foundation of federal court power in these kinds of situations, huh? And what did they ultimately decide? Like, what was their answer to that question?
Their answer was a clear and resounding yes. The court said, in no uncertain terms, that federal courts, they absolutely do have the power to review what state courts decide about federal constitutional issues, and they can do this through habeas corpus. And this remains true even if those very same issues, those constitutional questions, were fully argued out in the state courts. And even the U.S. Supreme Court had already denied certiorari. This was a huge, huge affirmation of the role that federal courts play in making sure that constitutional rights, you know, those fundamental rights, are actually being protected within the state criminal justice systems all across the country.
That's massive. So basically, what the state court decided wasn't automatically the final word when it came to these federal constitutional questions. Why not? It seems like maybe that could be stepping on the toes of the states and their own court systems, you know?
Right. And that's a really important tension. The court knew that, and they directly addressed it. There's this legal idea called res judicata, which basically means that you can't keep relitigating the same issues over and over once the court has made a decision. And some people were arguing that res judicata should apply here, you know, that the state court judgments should be the end of the story. But the Supreme Court in Brown v. Allen, they said, no, res judicata doesn't fully apply when we're talking about federal habeas review of state criminal convictions,
yeah,
especially when those convictions raise these federal constitutional issues.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit more. What was the reasoning behind that? Why did the court say that res judicata doesn't completely apply in these situations?
Well, their reasoning was really based on the fundamental purpose of federal habeas corpus, you know? They said habeas exists to protect people against potential violations of the U.S. Constitution. And that purpose, that essential function of habeas, it would be totally undermined if federal courts were automatically bound by whatever the state courts had decided about federal constitutional issues. I mean, think about it. There's always the possibility of errors, of biases, you know, within any system, including state court systems. And the writ of habeas corpus, the court said, it's there to make sure that people aren't being imprisoned in violation of their most basic constitutional rights. And the federal courts, they have a responsibility to independently assess those claims. They called it like a safety valve to make sure the Constitution is being upheld everywhere in every state.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like having this federal backstop to guarantee that constitutional protections are really being applied. And you mentioned earlier that in these specific cases, the Supreme Court had already denied certiorari. But the Brown v. Allen court, they said they didn't stop the federal courts from looking at the habeas petitions later. What was the reasoning behind that?
Exactly. The court was very clear about this. When the U.S. Supreme Court denies certiorari, it doesn't mean anything about whether the underlying constitutional claims are right or wrong. You know, it has no impact on the merits of the case. They said, look, a denial of certiorari just means that for whatever reason, we decided not to hear that particular case at that particular time. And there could be all sorts of reasons for that. You know, the Supreme Court might be super busy. Maybe the case wasn't procedurally ready, or there could be strategic reasons why they choose not to take a case. But it's not a judgment on the actual legal issues. So because of that, the fact that the Supreme Court had denied certiorari earlier, that didn't mean that the federal district court couldn't later examine the habeas petition and look at the constitutional claims that were being raised.
Okay, yeah, that's a really important distinction. So just because the Supreme Court decides not to take a case on direct appeal, that doesn't mean the door is completely closed. The federal courts can still look at it through this habeas corpus process. Now, what about the evidence itself? The court also said that the federal courts, they could even have their own evidentiary hearings, right? Like actually hearing evidence for themselves in these habeas cases. When would they do that?
You got it. So the court realized that sometimes just looking at the paper record, you know, the transcript and the filings from the state court, sometimes that's not enough to really get a full and fair picture of what happened, to really assess the constitutional claims. So they said, look, the federal courts, they have the power to hold their own evidentiary hearings if they need to. Like, if the state court record is incomplete for some reason, or if the person filing the habeas petition is saying, hey, here are some facts that weren't considered before, and if I can prove these facts, I should win my case. And those facts just weren't developed in the state court. Or maybe there's some other really strong reason why the federal court needs to gather more information. This gives federal courts the ability to really dig into the facts and make sure they have all the information they need to decide whether these constitutional claims are valid.
So they've got this power to review, and they can even dig up their own evidence if they need to. Right. What happened in the cases of Brown, Speller, and the Daniels brothers? Did any of them actually win their habeas petitions? Were their convictions overturned?
That's a great question. So even though the Supreme Court established this really important principle about the power of federal review, in the Brown v. Allen case itself, they actually ended up denying the habeas petitions for all four of the men. When it came to the claims about racial bias in the jury selection, they looked at all the evidence and said they couldn't find enough to say a constitutional violation happened. And for the claims about the coerced confessions, the court said that based on the record they had, the state court's decision that the confessions were voluntary, well, that was reasonable. And then in the Daniels brothers case, the court said that North Carolina's rule about filing appeals on time, you know, enforcing that rule in their specific case, they said it wasn't a violation of their right to due process.
So these particular guys, they didn't win their appeals, but the ruling itself had a huge impact on how much power federal courts have. It wasn't a unanimous decision, though, right? There were different opinions among the justices.
You're exactly right. The justices, they had different ideas about where to draw the line, you know. They all agreed federal courts have to make sure constitutional rights are protected. But how much power should they have to second guess what state courts do? Justice Reed, he wrote the main opinion. He said federal courts can't just ignore state procedural rules, but they still have to make sure the Constitution is being followed. Justice Jackson, he wrote a separate opinion, agreeing with the outcome, but really focusing on the importance of federal courts checking to make sure state court procedures are fair. Justice Frankfurter, he partially dissented. He said he usually respects state procedures, but he thought the jury bias claims needed a closer look because he was worried about racial discrimination. And then Justice Black, he wrote a really strong dissent, basically saying that the majority opinion was letting these procedural technicalities get in the way of seeing what he thought was obvious racial injustice in these cases.
Wow. So even on the Supreme Court, you've got these different legal minds really wrestling with these fundamental questions about how our system works. What's been the lasting legacy of Brown v. Allen? Why are we still talking about it today? What makes it so important for law students, you know, people who are really getting into the weeds of all this?
Brown v. Allen really changed how we think about federal habeas corpus. Before, it wasn't as clear the federal courts could step in after the state process was done, but this case made it crystal clear that they can and they should when the Constitution is at stake. And it set the stage for other cases that came later, like Save Noya, that gave even more power to federal courts to review these constitutional claims from state prisoners. It basically reshaped the legal landscape. You know, it meant that if you were convicted in state court, you had this path to federal court to argue that your constitutional rights were violated, even if you had already appealed all the way through the state system, and even if the U.S. Supreme Court didn't want to hear your case directly.
So to bring it all home for our listeners, the key takeaway here is this. Brown v. Allen made it absolutely clear that federal courts have the power to independently review federal constitutional claims, even if those claims were already decided by state courts, even if the U.S. Supreme Court already said they didn't want to hear the case directly. And the court, they specifically rejected the idea that this thing called res judicata, this legal principle that usually stops you from relitigating the same issue over and over, they said that doesn't prevent federal courts from doing this review. And they said that just because the Supreme Court denied certiorari in a case, that doesn't mean they agree with what the state court decided. And on top of all that, federal courts can even have their own evidentiary hearings if they need to get more information to figure out if someone's constitutional rights were violated.
Exactly right. And, you know, like we saw with all the different opinions from the justices, Brown v. Allen, it really highlights how tricky it is to balance these competing interests. making sure the federal government protects everyone's constitutional rights, but also respecting the way each state runs its own courts. This is an ongoing tension in our system, figuring out how to make sure individual rights are protected at the federal level while still letting states handle their own criminal justice systems.
Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive into Brown v. Allen for sure. It's amazing how this case from back in 1953 still has such a huge impact on how we understand the balance of power in our legal system, you know, and thinking about that balance, the balance between what states can do and how the federal government protects individual rights that Brown v. Allen really solidified, it raises this really important question. I mean, how is this framework, this balance that we've been talking about, how's it going to shape legal challenges in the 21st century, you know, especially when we see potential injustice happening at the state level or as we keep learning more about what our constitutional rights really mean in the face of all these new societal issues. That's something we're going to have to keep thinking about, debating, and working through. Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.